So this is hopefully an episode of the Ninja Consultant Podcast, where we're interviewing Felipe Smith, the author of Pipo Chu and MBQ, and I think some new project he's not allowed to talk about yet. Is that we cannot talk about yet? That's fine. We're at Manga Next, and this is 2012. So
before actually recording here, we're just talking about Japanese culture a little bit. So you found that, because you do think globally in terms of what you want to produce. You want to produce for a global audience, and yet you've identified Japan as the place where you will be able to best do what you want to do. Like, what brought you to that conclusion, and why do you feel that way?
About 10 years ago, I moved to Los Angeles, and I encountered a Japanese comic book stores, Kinokuniya, Asahiya, Mandarake, and like some of the, you know, used bookstores. So I was able to see for the first time an enormous amount of books in all sorts of genres, and realized that manga was not just Pokemon and Gundam and, you know, Sailor Moon, but actually there were stories about it, basically anything you could think of, from like cooking to law to sports, martial arts, you know, anything. I mean, anything was possible in that market. And that's when I decided that I really, you know, wanted to, you know, learn Japanese and work, take a shot at working over there, because then I thought I'd be able to do exactly the kind of stories I wanted to tell, which had nothing to do with fantasy or science fiction or adventure or anything particularly in any of those genres. You know, I wanted to tell stories about real life based on my own experience in life so far at the time. And yeah, I just, the other thing was just seeing that even adults in Japan read comic books, and it wasn't just kids, and it wasn't just a certain group in society. You know, it wasn't just like, you know, a video game or comic book or anime aficionados or geeks or whatever you want to call them. It was just like pretty much anybody, people who, like, the squarest of people were still reading comic books. So there was something special going on over there. So yeah, so that made me decide, like, okay, not only is it the largest industry when it comes to the comic book medium, because manga, comic books, bande dessinée, historieta, like whatever language you want to say the word comic book in, it's the same thing. It's basically vignettes, dialogue, and, you know, storylines, and they're printed on pages, and now, you know, you got it on the web, but it's basically the same art form, the same medium. So, you know, I didn't really make a distinction. The only extreme change is just that it's either black and white or color, depending on, you know, what country we're talking about. But yeah, I like black and white anyway. I think it gives the reader a lot more of a chance to use their own imagination and make their own calls on, you know, what something is. If you just draw an apple in black and white, it could be a green one or a red one. Whereas if you just make it red, that's it. You've not given the reader a choice to do anything. But it was basically that. The variety in genres and the fact that adults read, which I wanted to write stories for adults, not just for kids. At the time also, you know, manga was becoming very popular in the U.S. and in Europe. I mean, even Latin America. 2002, 2003, yeah. So I thought, okay, this is the way to do it. And that's why I made that choice.
So just before that, though, like, you went to art school, right? Did you work in, like, American animation or something? Or didn't you work at Spumco or somewhere for a while?
Yeah, actually, I worked at JRL Enterprises. It was a company that produced learning software for kids. They learned their ABCs and how to count and things like that. And it was all levels. It was actually implemented in public schools in the U.S. So it went everything from kindergarten to senior year in high school. Doing animation, simple animation, characters. It was, again, it was a style that was to be used in schools. So it was like for kids and kind of like a Disney style kind of thing. Nothing to do with what I'm doing right now. But it was a good experience. And I learned how to, like, do things for different markets. And I went to school at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago for fine arts, which had nothing to do with comics or cartoons or anything like that. It was actually looked down upon by those who were educating us about the arts. But there was an animation department, and that's where I learned how to animate. And then because of that, I got this job doing animation while I was in school. And then after graduating, I decided I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do something a little edgier and perhaps something that didn't have like a market and wasn't for kindergartners or anything like that. And so, I moved to LA where the animation studios are, and upon showing my work at different interviews, they told me I was insane. It was like, this isn't going to happen, because not only is this hard to produce design-wise, you know, it takes a lot of work to create characters that are, you know, this detailed for an animation. Well, I wasn't pitching shows. I was actually just trying to get a job working as an animator. But I was showing my portfolio, and they're like, well, not only is this not for kids, which at the time, the whole way of thinking was animation and comics are for kids. That's still pretty much dominant, but yeah, things have changed a lot. And also they're like, you know, you can't have these things, like these subject matters are completely inappropriate. And I'm like, you're not going to work in either industry unless you like get in line and start doing what everybody else is doing, which is something that to this day, even like 10 years later, like I don't want to do what everybody else is doing. Yes, I do think I know certain things concerning doing something new that can work. I still do think so.
I think that comes out like viscerally in the first volume of MBQ or something, where there's like a lot of kind of tendency toward MBQ, where it comes to kind of like in a ranting kind of way
about that.
No, I mean, I also like, because I could identify with that in some way, where like I went into animation and the people who I met working in animation in New York were people who had like worked on comics, but then they found that like there was slightly more money in animation. Like there's almost no money in comics, but like there was slight, you know, tens of dollars more in animation. that's what our director would say. He's like, we make literally tens of dollars working here. But a lot of the actual animation was being done like overseas. And then now a lot of the people I work with have like moved to Los Angeles. So that's always on the radar. But yeah, that was always something that was going on. Now I know more people who've like worked in comics, but they end up working in preschool animation as well, where it can eventually drive you crazy. What else?
You talk about a little bit about the kind of content more commercial institutions would look at and say, you know, you can't do this. We're talking specifically sex, drugs, but something that I also, even from your entry in Tokyo Pop, is gang culture. Right. I mean, there's so much more than any manga or comic or even anything short of those, the urban, what are they called? About 6 years ago on the subway, you could see everyone reading these black-oriented romance novels and reading over their shoulder. It's not romance. It's about hip-hop ballers getting chicks and, you know, banging them two at a time, which is there is almost zero crossover between that culture and comics culture. And where that intersection is your work, specifically. I guess, can you talk a little bit about that? Because that is unique to you, I think.
I haven't read any of these books that you're mentioning, but my whole thing is I didn't really read comics or manga myself when I started. I had a late start. I started my first series when I was 25 already. As a kid, my parents didn't buy me comics. My mom thought they were for like weak-minded people, and like, you know, it's like that whole thing is like. So I got, you know, I got storybooks, and that was it. And then, but I always liked to draw as a kid, and I liked talking and telling stories, and so it was just a medium that, you know, allowed for both. I thought this is exactly what I need to be doing. So without having read a lot of manga or comics, I started doing it. And even right now, even editors in Japan, when I'm doing thumbnails and showing them stuff, they're like, "Well, where are you getting this from?" Or like. Or they always try to go back on something that everybody knows. They're like, "Well, you know this series or that series they're doing," and I've never read any of these. And they're like, "How's it possible that you're like doing stories and publishing and you've never read anything?" And I believe you don't need to. Like, you need to know certain guidelines, you need to know the certain visual cues that people react to when reading a comic book, but you don't need to be a fan of any specific series or any specific author to be able to express yourself in the medium. And I think the difference when I'm working compared to maybe some other artists in Japan is that I use manga or comics as a vehicle for self-expression and wanting to communicate certain themes to an audience that pertain to my own life, my own existence, whereas other authors are just emulating things that they read as kids or that they were really big fans of, and they're changing it, you know, just enough to make it their own, and they're very happy just kind of doing like a second Dragon Ball, or, you know, I mean, like a lot of the shonen titles are always come from like a history of you know, certain kinds of books and just doing like the next wave and the same kind of thing, where for me, maybe I never found an attachment to any certain thing where I thought that's exactly what I want to do. And so I'm always kind of searching for a way to express myself through these stories and these characters and what I'm doing.
And we were talking about Bakuman a little bit earlier, and one of the things I find very frustrating about the series is that the team and their editor tells them what you do is it would be far better in the non-shonen world. You know, you guys are artistic, you're imaginative, you're creative, and that is not necessarily the best thing to bring into the shonen market. And they say, no, we want a best-selling series, we want an anime out of this. So for Bakuman, it's not even about artistic expression as much as it is living the dream. The dream being, yeah, reaching the status of a best-selling shonen mangaka. But what I was talking about earlier was in terms of what you uniquely bring, that element of gang culture, because it's really, it's in all three of your works that I've read. The third, I guess, being that Tokyo Pop Rising Stars entry, where it really stuck out because everything else was very much in the vein of manga. And then there was this entry that's like, what is this guy doing?
I've never been in any gang. I just want to clarify that. But living in major cities, you know, that's an element that, you know, sometimes you're exposed to. The reason I didn't write really about gang culture as much as like my environment and where I lived, you know. In West LA, there's not in a lot of gangs there by any means, you know. It's just one of the safer areas of Los Angeles. What I wanted to write was a story that regular people who might not necessarily read comics at all could identify with. And one of the things about making something realistic to a reader is putting elements that are recognizable for that reader. So foul language is something that's recognizable to anyone, whether they like it or not. And the reaction to it is going to be different, obviously, but it's something that is already realistic. So a lot of comic books have characters that their dialogue doesn't seem realistic at all. It's all, you know, they sound like something like a character in some, right, like comic book characters. Whereas if you have characters speaking and actually dropping the occasional F-bomb here and there, or like just using slang or mentioning current people who are in the media at the time or like celebrities, it already has an air of realism that you don't find in most comic books for some reason. I think back in the day, American comic books sounded a lot more realistic in terms of dialogue than they do right now. I think right now they might still be fashioned after the dialogue that was used a long time ago. And so now it becomes, you know, less realistic. It's like those old movies, like, hey, you see, hey, like people don't talk like that anymore, but back in the day they did, you know. Listen here, Mac, you know, like, people like, right. So my thing is, it wasn't so much, you know, putting in gang culture or anything like that, which, you know, I don't think violence or gang activity or anything like, or crime, you know, I'm not saying anything, any of that is good, or I'm not trying to glorify it either, but it is an aspect of real life, you know, that I think people don't see in comics, and it was something I wanted to put in. I think my main objective, and it still is right now, when I say I look for a global audience, what I look for is not a niche audience. Like, I want anybody, whether it be like somebody, a self-proclaimed otaku, or somebody who is definitely not into comics, to be able to read what I do and be like, hey, you know what? I'm not into comics, but this is actually really interesting, and like, I kind of like it, which I have received emails of people telling me, like, I don't even read comics, but my friend who does has given me your books and, like, told me I would like them. And after, like, just refusing to read it, I finally read them, and I'm like, your books are the only ones I own that are comics, which makes you happy. But not only those people, which were, like, kind of, I don't know, like a project of mine or something that I was aiming towards, because most of my friends don't read comics to begin with, and even my family and relatives, they support what I do, but, like, they don't read anything that's not mine because it's just not what they're into. So that was, like, kind of like an audience that I really, and still, you know, want to reach. But also do something that somebody, a really avid manga or anime viewer or manga reader or comic book reader, would pick up and think, hey, like, you know, this is not the regular shonen stuff I look at, but, like, I'm completely entertained by it, and these characters are, like, appealing and, like, they draw me in. So I think in the Japanese market, doing that is not what most publishers would want. They would want you to attack a certain demographic and just sell well in that one niche, which is something that, being outside of the market when I was in the U.S. looking at manga, I thought there's all sorts of stuff, so you can do whatever you want. And what I realize now in the market is that, no, like, yes, you have to be as specific as you can be is what you should be, the direction you should be going into.
Can you give some specific examples of difficulties that you had with editors, ideas that they wouldn't greenlight, things that you really fought for?
Oh, because I wanted to bring up, like, the kind of Bakuman example. One thing that they do that I think they portray well in that is, like, how many ideas the writer kid comes up with that the editors reject, where he fills, like, notebook after notebook of, like, pitch ideas that they throw out. So I was wondering, like, how many ideas have you pitched, like, per title that, like, the editor refused, that kind of thing?
Ideas get rejected all the time. When you do your thumbnails initially, you know, you do the dialogue and all the art, you turn them in. If your chapter's like, you know, 18 pages for a weekly, or like, you know, 36 to 60 for a monthly, depending, you do that. And then that's like the first run. So, I mean, you've put in a lot of effort to do all these pages, but you could just be asked to do it all over again, completely different direction, you know. Average, when I first started out, they kind of gave me like a loose kind of, just kind of let me do what I came up with, you know, and then they would look it over. If nothing looked really bad, then they're like, okay. Well, actually, it had to look good no matter what. It had to seem like something that would work. After a while, as the series progresses and they get, you know, input from readers, then they can try to see, like, okay, if we do more of this, or if this character becomes more of a significant character in the storyline, the series will get more popular with a certain demographic or whatever. By the end of the series, there's a 3-volume series, people, too, about 250 pages each volume. So by the end, You know, I was actually asked sometimes to like rewrite my chapter like 3 times without the deadline changing at all. So, you know, you have like 1 month to do like 40 to 60 pages and you're doing these thumbnails and they ask you to redo them. So in the end, I ended up doing these 36 pages or 40 pages in about 2 weeks. In terms of series pitches, wow, like I've pitched 5 series ideas, completely different genres and everything that have just not been accepted. Sometimes, you know, you'll turn something in where you're like, ah, this is not going to get accepted because you don't really think it's up to par with. That was the case with some of them where, I mean, if they would have allowed me to do it, I would have been able to do it, you know, but they wasn't like super gung-ho about it. A couple actually I think would really work, maybe even in a different market. They would do like pretty well just in terms of like looking at trends and stuff, but not particularly for what they wanted. And also it has to do with your publisher too. I think a lot of manga artists growing up reading manga, you know which magazine is kind of more your vein of, you know, and so you go and you pitch there. So if you're into like Super Shonen type stuff, you're not going to go pitch to like Morning, which is like basically a publication for like businessmen or salarymen. In my situation, you know, being a foreign artist, there aren't a lot of publishers who are interested in working in with foreign artists. Or there weren't, at least in like 2008 when I moved to Japan for the first time, because of many reasons. Like in a decade before that, Kodansha, same publisher, had actually tried to work with many artists from Europe and North America, South America, and they had in some cases flown them out there and everything, and it really didn't do well. Nothing sold. Some of them, a lot of them just weren't even able to publish because the publisher just didn't even seem it was like up to standard. And I think a lot of the problem was not only the inability for a lot of artists to like keep up with the deadlines, which they're crazy, like they're insane. I mean, I can say it, I've done it for a year and a half, a little bit over a year and a half, and I still think it is insane, but it's something that I have to do to, well, first of all, to prove that you don't need to be Japanese to work in the Japanese market. Second, to kind of like stop this whole thing about like what manga and comics is, and you know, no, I'm from the States, and I was raised in Argentina, like, and now I'm in Japan, and I'm doing it, and it has nothing to do with anything. There's no specific style for manga, there's none of that. So I'm hoping, you know, that idea has already been thrown out the window because of what I've done. But yeah, it's an insane schedule, and most artists that I know that have worked in other markets in the world, they don't even want to work that way. Which Bakuman is also a way of, I think it's a way of like, it's a positive propaganda towards getting people to do weeklies again, and kind of trying to teach like young readers that like the insane schedule is definitely worth the respect you get and the honor of doing this. Which, again, I mean, for somebody who's been, and I've never even done a weekly, mind you, like my schedule was insane and I had very little time off working, and it was a monthly still. A weekly, you've got 18 pages a week, you've got 7 days to put those together, and 4 of those days are usually dedicated to working out the story with your editor. People who are really good and get their thumbnails accepted really quickly could have more time to do the final pages, but I mean, on average, most people do their 18 pages in 3 days. Assistants are not, you know, that's usually the schedule. So you don't have a lot of time other than for like sleeping and eating. Some people are really quick in terms of like, usually if you can come up with a story really quickly and get it accepted, it'll make your life a lot easier when it comes to like doing everything else. I think you asked me about like what certain things might have not been allowed in terms of like themes or like working in stories. I think a lot of the challenge of working as a foreigner is that you bring themes to the table that are sometimes not the norm in Japan for cultural reasons, or sometimes what's entertaining in one culture is not as entertaining in another, and vice versa. So for me, you know, and definitely what I aimed towards was maybe not what every artist usually aims for in Japan. And with Pipochu, I wanted to do something that, again, like specifically a Japanese audience and an American audience could like get something out of, you know. And so I talk about cultural differences, maybe misconceptions that both the U.S. and Japan have about each other mutually, you know, and just things that you would encounter as a Westerner going to Japan for the first time. But as a Westerner who already has kind of this like love or this really big interest for this country and all the things that come out of the country, but then finally going within and seeing really how things are from, you know, day-to-day life. And also the language thing can be a big challenge for any Westerner. I mean, I went there, luckily, you know, already speaking and reading and writing to a degree. And then, you know, I've been there over 4 years now, and like meetings are like a breeze. I mean, right now. But when I started out, I actually had an interpreter for the first 3 months, because even though I did understand, you know, I was missing a lot of just vocabulary in general. So, and when you're having a meeting where you're expressing ideas and what you want to convey to an audience and the manner in which you want to do it, there's a lot of words that if you've taught yourself Japanese, you're not going to be aware of. So I was constantly taking down notes, looking things up in my digital dictionary.
So you learned Japanese by working at like a karaoke place, I think? Yeah. So was it difficult in meetings? Or do you mean like they were speaking like business Japanese that was hard to learn, or it was just...
Yeah. I learned at a... Well, I couldn't go to... I didn't have money to go to school and learn Japanese, and I needed a job desperately. So I started working at a Japanese karaoke bar, you know, West LA, Olympic and Sawtelle. That's like the Japanese area of West LA. And yeah, I just basically served drinks and like changed discs and took people's reservations. But everybody else who worked there was Japanese, and so was the owner, and half of the customers were. So all the menus and everything were in Japanese. I just told everybody, like, I need to learn Japanese because I want to draw manga, and I need to be able to learn Japanese for business. So please, you know, I don't want to learn a lot of slang. I want to speak it correctly. And so, you know, there's Hyojungo, which is like the basic standard Japanese that is used in Tokyo. And so everybody from different regions of Japan moves to Tokyo for work, and they all have to change the way they speak in order to like not be misunderstood by everybody who lives there. So that's what I wanted to learn. Now, the thing is, there's very technical words that are used when you're trying to explain something. And those things, you know, you learn them in time, you know. I mean, I think you never even stop learning your own language. There's always going to be words in the dictionary or in novels or whatever that you have to look up. Case, and that was the case with me. I had a very standard, maybe, I wouldn't say junior high or high school level, because the way I learned through interest. So I wouldn't know how to explain things about drawing techniques, but I wouldn't know like the word for like, you know, turtle or airplane or something like that. So that would always like confuse people in Japan, because I could speak to them, you know, very fluently compared to most of the foreigners they encountered in their own country. But at the same time, the level of kanji I could read would go from something super technical to not being able to write teddy bear or something, you know. If you do want to work in any of those industries, especially one where you're writing your own stories, you need to be able to communicate. So that was important.
I did want to talk a little bit about your relationship with your editors, which I understand from talking to Ed and reading Bakuman that it's a really important relationship in manga that I don't think happens in Western comics. And the people I know who've done kind of graphic novels for like publishers here in America that aren't usual graphic novel publishers, they get almost no editorial feedback, and they just turn in a bunch of pages that are generally like approved with no like panel-to-panel breakdown or anything. And I also want to mention, didn't they switch editors on you at one point? What that was like?
Okay, so yeah, actually your relationship with your editor is really important. My first editor, well, now he's the head, he's the editor-in-chief of Morning. He said, you know, the relationship between an artist and his editor is like a marriage. Considering how many times you meet with your editor and talk about stuff, and that, you know, sometimes you'll get a phone call at 2 a.m, and then you'll discuss over the phone your series or your character for like 2 hours easily. For me, it was easier for them to bring me out to the office than to talk on the phone, just because of like maybe language things that might arise. Where lately it hasn't been so much that way. I mean, I can just have a meeting about stuff on the phone. But yeah, I would go down to the office sometimes at 3 a.m, and we'd have a meeting until like 8 a.m. about certain scenes or something. The relationship is really important. Finding an editor that really understands what you're trying to do with your work is super important. And not only that, they need to really like what you're doing as well. That's not always the case. Sometimes you work with editors that like are not even particularly fond of what you're doing. It makes it harder. They get assigned to you. So, you know, it's a kind of a luck of the draw thing. Some artists, when they get a choice, they get a chance, they always go with the same editor. So even if they're working at different publishers, they'll just hire that editor to work. So if it's a big seller, you know, a big seller, and the publisher's like, we want to work with you. And I'm like, okay, but I work with this editor. So, and that can happen or not happen, but it's happened with some artists. And you do talk all the time about all sorts of things, and you go out for dinner a lot, and you go out for drinks a lot. And it's also a way of like relieving stress. Like, people working in the comic book industry deal with a lot of stress. I mean, it's not even people just in the comic book industry. I think people working in any industry in Tokyo, because of the work hours and because of just the way the city is in general, you deal with a lot of stress. And that's why they have so many places for like singing karaoke or drinking, or there's a lot of entertainment that's 24/7. And it's because people really need to like get some of this energy out. They're long hours, you have very little time for family and friends, which is also a big factor. I think if you want to work over there, you need to understand that. Well, to any foreigner, they would know that, because your family is most likely not in Japan, and neither are your friends. So I think anybody who wants to pursue that already knows that they're going to be pretty much solo for a long time. But that's the life of a comic book artist over there. And your editor becomes one of your people you hang out with the most, which is good when you're creating stories, because a lot of times you go with very little sleep, and you're constantly drawing and you're constantly thinking about stuff. And so having another person there to kind of see things a little more objectively and from outside, and probably a little bit more sleep than you when you're working, helps, because they can see things that you're missing. And also, the more, you know, the longer of a relationship you have with an editor, the more they understand where you're trying to get at. So sometimes when you're kind of in a hole and you're just you can't kind of find a different angle to do this thing, they can tell you, oh, well, this is, I think this is what you're trying to do, right? So maybe if you did this and that and this character actually said this instead, your point would get across like really easily. So that's the thing about working over there is they need a face-to-face relationship and definitely meetings about your work, where working with editors in the U.S., for instance, you might never even meet that editor in person. You'll talk to them on the phone definitely whenever there's something to be discussed. The relationship with the editor in the Japanese industry is, you know, they're a lot more hands-on with the project and they're kind of, you know, they're there with you the whole way. So
in terms of how you had initially conceptualized Pipuchu, how is the end result different as a result of that collaboration?
I think thanks to collaboration, it was became more solid of a series in terms of reaching the Japanese audience with the themes I was trying to convey. The story didn't change at all. I usually plan my stories with an ending in mind, a definite ending in mind. I know how things want to conclude. I want to conclude things because the end of a series is when you can leave your message with your reader, you know. And I think the whole series should work its way towards something. That is not the case with maybe most of series in Japan. I don't think most series don't really have a very solid ending, or some of them do, but a lot of artists actually create their story through a character that they want to draw. They're like, I like this kind of character and I want to draw. I don't particularly work that way. I have a definite message I want to give the reader, and then I create characters around that message for it to work. That's the way I do things. But in terms of the series, it was pretty much what I wanted to do. It ended the way I wanted it to end, and not there weren't a lot of changes. But it was a story about an American, well, in this case, an otaku of this anime called Pipuchu, who cosplays like the character and wants to go to Japan and gets a chance to do so. But while living in Japan, I encountered a lot of things that were culturally shocking to me as well. And so I would put those in the story. So when I went to Japan, I had a storyline. I knew enough about Japan to know where things would take place and what kind of characters there would be who would be Japanese or American. But while living there, more and more, I could inform the story with things that I was experiencing firsthand and, you know, things that were going on in terms of trends and, you know, in terms of fashion trends or entertainment. I could actually put those in. So I think as I lived there, it got more and more solid in terms of those aspects of the story.
Was there anything specific that they pushed back on that you can recall? Yeah.
Yeah, I think, and this has to do a little bit also with the way I tell my stories, which has to do with, again, being a Westerner. I think Westerners tend to be more direct in terms of conveying ideas and saying, you know, this is, I like this or I don't like this, or this is good and this is bad. And I think we're also used to not agreeing on things and being okay with it sometimes. Where in Japan, there's a less direct way of conveying ideas or emotions. A lot of times I would want to write a scene where, you know, Westerners would see something that's like, would be really shocking to us, that is just very commonplace in Japan. And so I would go directly, try to show it as, you know, as how we would see it. And they would then say, hey, you know, like, are you trying to upset the reader? Or like, what are you doing? Like, this is, you definitely need to find a different way of doing it.
Specific instances?
Yeah. Well, it usually deals with like more like adult subjects, like certain service industries that you might find for adults in society. You know, where like, you know, in a country like the U.S., they're illegal and you'll be arrested for them. Not only the person providing the services, but the person purchasing the service will be arrested because it's illegal. But in other countries, it's not so much so. And in some countries, technically it's illegal, but it is kind of like not penalized. I had this chapter where it talked about McDonald's. There's this character, Jody, and he just really wants to get lucky with a girl in Japan. And he tries really hard and he's completely miserably fails every time. But he's constantly bombarded with these very sexy images in the media in Japan and in magazines and everywhere. And, you know, he's going crazy and he's walking around and he goes to a McDonald's to get some food. And then he notices the attire of the girls working at McDonald's, and they're wearing these mini skirts and these really tight vests. And he's like, that's crazy. Like, you know, the business women are dressed a certain way and that, as a Westerner, seemed very sexy to him, where in the U.S. there's different dress codes for the work environment. And so he goes even to a McDonald's, you know, like people are wearing mini skirts and stuff, and it's driving him nuts. And then as he walks out, he's walking around the streets in Kabukicho, which is like a water business district. So it means like bars and hostess clubs and other, you know, more like prostitution places and stuff. No, okay, you know. Okay. So he's walking around there and he's just seeing all these basically brothels that are, for some reason, have like signs that make it very obvious what it is. There's photos of the people available for services and they have their names, which are fake names, but then they have like all the things that you can do and the price for them. And it's just like a McDonald's menu. You know, and it, which to maybe a Westerner, that would be mind-blowing, that it's just so, just they're so outspoken about it, and it seems so natural to do that. So it's very extreme. And in a lot of ways, you know, I talked just before about, like, not being so direct in terms of conveying ideas. But in another way, this is, like, super direct, where in our culture, you know, it's very hidden and kind of, like, in the back. And here, it's just up front, and nobody feels anything about it. So those kind of differences can be shocking to a Westerner, and I wanted to put them in there. But I was asked, I mean, that made it into the chapter. It's the thing, the last volume of People Chew, it's in there. But my editor had a concern. He said, well, what would you know, an American reader think about this scene? Like, what would they think about it? What I told them is some people would be completely appalled by it, you know, and it would be a side of Japan that they would never had imagined existed. And other people would be completely thrilled about it and would love to go to Japan because Japan is less strict about these things, or, like, less uptight about certain things. You know, there's no right or wrong in these things. And, like, even though we all have an opinion about certain things and a certain stance on certain issues, when my whole objective when drawing people to was just informing people of, like, what's out there. What's out there in the U.S.? You know, what's out there in Japan? Like, does every American own a gun? You know, does everybody tattoo? Is every Japanese person, like, a expert martial artist? Does everybody watch anime? Like, you know, is everybody cosplay and wear gothic Lolita things? You know, are all American guys romantic? Or is everybody like some Brad Pitt movie? Are all American women, like, super strong and scary and mean? And so some of these things I've listed, some of them will seem completely ridiculous to the listener, but then others will make you think a little bit, like, wait, are we that strong as women? Or, like, are we not, like, submissive in some departments? Or is every Japanese woman a certain way, or every Japanese businessman a certain way? Those are all things that I wanted to explore. And obviously, you know, I put action and comedy in there. But yeah, those are things that the editorial department always wanted to know, and that sometimes you would have a conflict where I really wanted to talk about a certain subject, and they're like, hey, buddy, come on. You're trying to make us look bad, or you're trying to, you know. And other times they would just tell me, like, I really want to talk about something. And they're like, well, that's just, like, really common to us. Like, that's not entertaining to a Japanese reader. One thing that really worked well, I think, in both for the American audience and the Japanese audience was the Japanese toilet scene, where Jody and Milton go to a Japanese hotel and they see the washlet toilet for the first time. And it's, you know, they got buttons and it makes sounds. In some cases, your toilet will make little music. For me, the first time I saw a Japanese toilet with the washlet and buttons on it and stuff, I knew nothing about it. You know, nowadays I think people see it on the internet. But I just thought, wow, like, Japan technology, like, even the toilet, the most, like, non-technological object you could have in your house. It's a very basic thing. Like, you had buttons and lights, and it even had instructions on how to, like, use it. And it's a toilet, man. Like,
and not to take pictures.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, so that scene, you know, like, I kind of, like, over-exaggerated visually, like, what the encounter with the toilet is for an American. And, like, the Japanese really liked that. The readers really thought it really funny. And I actually, just last month, I had a show at the Kyoto International Manga Museum. And you know, I gave them all these files and stuff to choose from. And that's one of the images they chose. It's like it's a two-page spread of them, like, looking at this toilet for the first time and freaking out. And the toilet looks like this spaceship with, like, buttons and everything all over it.
But I do want to at least be sure to hit on, like, the early death age of manga artists, which is something that comes up in Bakuman, and your sort of, like, physical condition of the cost of sitting for 20 hours a day and sleeping four or whatever. I did find on our podcast, like, one graphic that got really popular is Ed Gibbous, this one magazine that had the schedule of a weekly manga artist, and it turned out to be the guy who does Nura Rise of the Yokai Clan for, like, Weekly Shonen Jump, who'd started off as an assistant for, like, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, but he charts out his daily schedule by hours. Like, the sleep is really only, like, 4 or 5 hours a night, and then there are 4 hours on Sunday that are his free time, and, like, the rest of it's, like, half the week is pitching with his editor, and the other half is working with assistants and things like that, but... Yeah, so let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. You have very little time for yourself other than work. Most of the time, everybody uses it for sleep. So, I mean, they'll say, like, if you talk about it, usually that's just what everybody puts their time into, is just sleep, because you need it. It's very hard to work without sleep, but a lot of times you have to. What's crazy is there's pages in People Chew I don't remember drawing. Like, I know it's me, and nobody else could have drawn them, but I don't remember. Usually when you draw things, you can look at a drawing and remember when you were doing it, what music you were listening to. That's kind of like a fun thing. But, yeah, there's pages I just don't remember. I was and I have been up for, like, 2 days or 3 days with, like, almost no sleep. Yeah, sitting down like all day, that's not good. You actually, and my editor told me this at first. I thought it was weird. He said, you know, like you're like a, you know, decently pretty, you know, pretty big built guy. Like you're gonna do fine drawing manga. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, what does that have to do with anything? You know, like. And the reason he said that is because you need a lot of like physical strength, and I mean, you're basically forcing your body into like being stationary. You're just sitting there, and that's like not really good for you. So you actually have to train your body. You have to go out and walk or like run or do something to not like completely deteriorate from sitting at a chair drawing. Most of the energy that's used is like mental. Like you're constantly thinking about stuff. I think the best stage for me, at least, is when I'm actually like drawing or inking the final pages. Like there's no thinking at all going on. Like you can listen to like movies. I've listened to so many movies. I haven't watched them. I listen to them while I draw. It's pretty much what you're doing is you're just looking at paper pretty much for like forever. It's not really good for you. So like, again, Bakuman shows that. I think it's probably realistic in the depiction of all the different areas pertaining to drawing comic books. Yeah, definitely you can fall ill to to things. And actually three artists in the magazine that I publish in ended up like hospitalized, but they all made their deadlines, which is very important. I mean, you have to make your deadlines. So just try not to get sick just so you don't miss your deadlines. And usually whatever you do in life when you're drawing a series is goes around what your deadline is. So going out with friends, going out on a date, do anything, buying stuff or like shopping for like furniture, it all has to do with your deadline. If you don't think you're going to make your deadline, you don't do any of those. You don't go out with your friends, you don't, because that's like the number one thing. I've had the flu while finishing up project, and I mean, I didn't even, you know, usually you got the flu or something serious and you're like, you call work right away. You're like, I'm not going in, and like, you know, like, and maybe, you know, but that's, I did not want to call or say anything because it didn't matter. Like I had to get my work done. Like it was a very small apartment, so like my bathroom, which is another reason why, like, I got, they call it economy shock in Japan, but basically, you know, like when sometimes some people get on an airplane on a long flight and then like their legs, like their ankles will swell up, like their feet. Yeah, I got that from just sitting down and drawing like every day and not like moving around a lot. And it's really, I'm in this little shoebox size apartment, which is funny because they call it mansion in Japan. They call it a mansion. And a mansion is just a shoebox. That's where everybody lives. I thought is hilarious, but it's another example of like English words that are used to like an almost sometimes opposite meaning in the real, like. And so, you know, everybody lives in a mansion in Tokyo, you know. You know, the bathroom was like 4 steps away from my chair, and my bed was 6 steps away from my chair.
Sounds like a prison cell.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I was just like taking 4 steps to the bathroom to vomit and then go back to like inking my pages, and I had a busting headache. Maybe that's why I don't remember the pages. Like maybe I just, but you know, it's amazing the things you can do under pressure, man. I think like, well, think of it this way. I did 750 pages in a year and a half, and that's 3 graphic novels. I mean, I'm glad I did, and you know, I mean, it's just something you have to do. But yeah, you have to eat right. That's the first thing you have to do. Make sure you eat like your vegetables and your fruit. Get your vitamins, you know, where you can. I got anemia also from just not eating. I didn't have like, they're like, no, you don't have enough iron in your diet. So I mean, little things that you don't think of. Also, I'm really bad because I can eat the same thing for like forever and not change. Like I could eat like curried rice for like 2 years straight and not care. But I began to be really conscious of what I ate. Like, okay, I need to eat like vegetables today. I got to eat something different, kind of change my diet, you know, and like make an effort to like move. And things are so convenient. They're so convenient that they become an inconvenience. In Japan, I was on a first floor apartment and I had a convenience store right in front of me and a grocery store not even a minute away from my apartment. So not only did I not go up any stairs, I could get my food in like 30 seconds across the street. So my fridge was empty because my fridge was just a convenience store 30 seconds from my apartment. So it was like the worst scenario ever. I was eating food like just pumped with like preservatives and like MSG. I was not moving. I was probably walking the equivalent of maybe 1 block a day. If you think about like, you know, just like the 4 steps to the bathroom and like maybe like the 20 steps to the convenience store a couple times a day, I was seriously just walking maybe 1 block a day and eating stuff that's bad for me and getting little sleep. And that will destroy your body, obviously, you know? Like, I watched Super Size Me. That guy at least walked to his car. You know, he walked more than I did, you know? So you got to be really careful. I mean, if you're going to do that, like, you really need to, like, make an effort to go out and, like, run a little bit or at least walk and drink plenty of, like, water.
Did you work that into your schedule eventually? And also, like, I don't think it's just, like you were saying, it's not just manga that in Japanese work culture where people are working themselves to death, like it happens in other industries too, where people don't get a break. You can tell that by the size of the energy drink section in the Japanese convenience store. So I was going to ask, did you try any of those? Do you have a favorite Japanese energy drink?
Yes, I tried plenty of them, like too many. The funny thing that I learned is that the Red Bull in Japan, the dosage is way lower than the American one. Yeah, completely. Like, you drink them and you're like, no, man, this is not working, you know? But they have really strong ones. They taste really bad. Yeah, they cost like $10. You know, and I didn't get those because I was trying to hold on to my money, you know? But, you know, coffee and stuff. You know, I'm not really a big coffee drinker, so I would drink coffee while I was the last stages of my deadline. Yeah, they have a huge selection of, like, energy drinks. And the thing is, people don't get a lot of sleep. Like, businessmen, I mean, the mangaka is, like, the businessman of the art world in Japan. I mean, and there's not, personally, I don't think there's, like, a really big art world. It's just kind of, like, mangaka are not even really seen as artists by a lot of people. They're just kind of seen as producers, like, entertainers kind of thing. But also, businessmen don't have a lot of time to eat or drink. So a lot of times, meals will be substituted by these things, these little bars or these, yeah, the Calorie Made and those kind of things. So, yeah, it's harsh. It's a harsh lifestyle, man. Like, for a lot of people, I mean, for a lot of people in Tokyo, it's just a harsh lifestyle. Not a lot of sleep, a lot of work, a lot of stress. I mean, it's a city packed with people. I mean, I worked at home. Riding the train, man, it's packed. I mean, they got people pushing you in. It's like, insane.
But you moved to Osaka, and why, how did that happen, and why did you move to Osaka? Is it different than Tokyo in that case?
Yeah, Osaka and Tokyo are rival cities. I like Osaka way better than Tokyo, like, just hands down. I would advise any foreigner, if they plan on living in Japan, to live in Osaka and not Tokyo, because of the culture. It's a very different culture. People in Osaka are, like, way more, you know, kind of just upbeat. They'd like to talk, they joke around. They're more frank in their conveying of ideas and the way they feel about things, where in Tokyo, it's seen as a better thing not to avoid conflict. People in Osaka are cool with having conflict, and, you know, and that also that's why it's easier to make really good friends, because you know who they are and stuff. They're not as worried about offending, quote unquote, because a lot of things, anything could be considered offensive sometimes. I mean, things to us that would be like, okay, what, you don't agree with me, that's cool. In certain scenarios, it's not cool to not agree with everyone. So, you know, where Osaka is kind of more free-spirited, just kind of, hey, whatever. Now, there's all the work is in Tokyo. And so depending on what you do for work, you probably could not go to Osaka. No, well, the thing about comic books is you can live wherever you want in Japan as long as you can meet your editor in person, and they'll take the bullet train to go out and meet with you, or they'll pay for you to take the bullet train to go down. So I can still meet with editors. I go to the publisher every once in a while. And you don't have to go to the publisher all the time, maybe once a month, you know, and it's like 2 hours on the bullet train to go to Tokyo. Or if you want to take the bus, it's like $25 because it's like $200 for the bullet train. Take the bus, it's like 8 or 9 hours, but I usually take the bus. I'm not trying to. That's if the publisher doesn't expense your trip. Like, I go because I got friends in Tokyo too. Food in Osaka is delicious and, like, way cheaper. It's like Osaka is way cheaper than Tokyo, and the food, they pride themselves on having really great food that is inexpensive. And it's almost like if your food is expensive, it's probably not good. Like, that's the mentality there. So once you get, you know, yeah. Once you get used to that in Osaka, you know, going back to Tokyo can be really hard. But I will say, you know, coming from whatever country you're from, you know, maybe if it's not an Asian country, it's still Japan. Osaka is still Japan, and a lot of things that can be shocking about, it's just, not shocking is not the right word, surprising about the way people do things. I think for me, personally, I'm glad I went to Tokyo first, because I enjoy Osaka so much more because of that.
Right. So the other major thing I wanted to cover was sort of, like, living expenses and do you pay your own rent and that sort of thing? Because specifically with the page output per month, it's kind of like, compared to American comics, that's like an untenable number of pages. Like, nobody does. Like, American pamphlet comics are, like, so short. But nobody, right, but nobody does, like, a jillion pages. Although I guess I do know a guy who's working now for Marvel who's, like, a lot of pages. But, like, I met an artist who moved here who was, like, I was drawing 40 pages a month to get by, and I'd had enough of that, and I stopped. And, like, he wanted to be a fine artist instead. It didn't really work out. But I just wanted to, like, I think people can make more of a living usually through manga. Like the major publishers pay, what I understand is they pay a better salary. But then I guess if you broke it down by hour, maybe not.
Well, I think people who do manga, they want to do that and they're in for that. And they would rather, and a lot of the people I've met, there's nothing they'd rather be doing than that. Being paid just to do that and make a living of it is good enough and they're not going to complain. And yeah, of course I pay my own rent. And yeah, and I mean, luckily I was picked up by Kodansha, which is the biggest publisher over there. So they're able to pay me, you know. Well, where other publishers and some of the indies pay less, some of them don't even pay until the books come out. So it all depends on who you're working with. But yeah, you pay your own rent. I mean, you have to pay your health coverage, which, yo, that was... I'm under the same health insurance as like regular Japanese, like Kokumin something, Hokken. Kengo Hokken, the national one, yeah. But yo, it was like... it ended up being like $500 a month, like another rent, you know, and it's like... What's the case here? Is it like similar?
It is the biggest problem with America. Like employment in America is now health coverage, because if
when I was in temp, they wanted $600 or $700.
Yo,
and that's
if you live somewhere else, it's $400. If you're right. Out of pocket, but
it's not like that's some platinum
your employer
guarantee plan that'll get you in to see a doctor.
Right.
And on top of that,
yeah, anything
all of the treatment fees and all of the. It's
insane, man.
It is now. It has reached a level where we will probably, yes, it is really a crisis
in
right.
America.
Yes.
It's kind of ridiculous that, you know, we have such a high standard of living otherwise, except in this one incredibly important sector.
Right.
So I don't know. I've heard good things about the way that the Japanese healthcare system works, in that it sort of does work, but I didn't realize that it was also as expensive.
Oh, yeah.
As you would find elsewhere.
Right. What's that? The health insurance? Are we, oh, you're asking about rent and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing I want, I guess any you know, listener who wants to draw, your assistants, you have to pay for out of your own pocket. Your publisher does not provide you with like a team of like assistant ninjas to do all your work for you. Like, you have to pay them. And the general rate is like at least $100 a day. And when you're starting out as a comic book artist, you're a beginning artist like me. I mean, I had a series before in the States, but like it doesn't count in the Japanese department, so in the industry. And the page rate isn't really high. Like the American page rates are like at least three times more than they are in Japan for any publisher, even Kodansha or Shueisha or Shogakukan. So you really have to budget yourself, because you pay for your assistants the day of work, you pay for your assistants' food and transportation. So, and that's all out of your own pocket. And so you have to like really make a budget. The publisher only pays you for the pages you turn in, and then you have to use that money to like manage everything else.
Really, what you should be doing is you should be having kids. You have kids,
and you make them
work as your assistants
because you're feeding them anyways.
Just marry another mangaka, and the two of you. It's like a cottage industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question that's sort of apropos of nothing we've been discussing about your art in particular, your style, or at least the style that you sort of championed in these, in what I have seen, is like much larger than life. Like it's some of the you know, your more muscular characters, they're not, because you know you don't do superhero comics, but the way that they're built would rival any superhero. And the same goes for the women. You know, they're like ridiculously voluptuous, and you know, you have this sort of level of sexiness where it's sort of every aspect of the body is like shiny and sort of, you know, it's like every part of it is sort of like pornographic. Like you're really trying to get into that level of detail. And I'm just wondering where you draw that from. I mean, the more muscular characters I do, I see a lot of like superhero style. But as far as the, you know, the women, the sexy details, I don't know, like, where are you pulling that from? Do you have inspirations? Your Chicago school, that's like more classical background.
Right.
What, how did you learn? Where did you get this stuff?
I think everything that I learned at fine art school that had nothing to do with comics or animation, but had all to do with like invoking certain responses from an audience, I use in my comic books. In terms of figures, well, I think, you know, the thing about comics is that you're not only are using words to convey meaning, you're also using visuals. And because with a line, you can do whatever you want. Sometimes, you know, I really want to like, you know, really show you like overboard something. I want to give you a real feeling. So if somebody's like a really big person, and I got that from like, just like Fist of the North Star, you'd see these characters that are like 30 feet tall. Like, that's not, you know, yeah, yeah. Exactly, yeah. And, you know, I'm very entertained by that kind of stuff. I do want to say maybe for, you know, maybe a lot of your listeners have never seen any of my work. I have the opposite to counter all of these things. So I have, like, giant dudes and, like, maybe women who are, like, completely super voluptuous. But there are other characters, like maybe Milton or, like, Tanaka Busaiku or, like, Jody, who are, like, either normal or, like, super lanky. Or, like, I like to play with shapes. I think character design is really important in any kind of storytelling. If you can show a lot about the character through the way they look without them having to say anything, it adds a lot. And a lot of times you can play with that. You can have a character looking exactly like the opposite of what they are. So somebody could look like the total villain and be the sweetest person in the story. And somebody could look like such an innocent, kind of fragile, meek character being completely powerful and threatening, you know. So those are things that visually you can kind of play with the reader. And I think the reader enjoys a story the most when they're not sure what's going on. If they're too lost, it's not good. But if they know exactly what's going to happen, then it becomes boring. In terms of like the sexuality of some of the scenes or the images. As a kid growing up in Buenos Aires, Argentina, a lot of comics were, all the comics were black and white because there's no money really for the industry. A lot of the artists found really good ways of just doing stuff with ink and paper without even tones, which tones are expensive. And I learned, I mean, as a kid, I still saw like a lot of black and white comics. In Argentina, nobody read comics. There wasn't a big, you know, after like the 50s or something, like people kind of stopped reading. So the only way to get people to buy them would be to have like ultra violent stuff or like ultra sexual stuff in there. So as a kid, we couldn't buy any like pornography was still available like in magazines and tapes alone, you know, there was no internet or anything like that. Couldn't buy any of that stuff. You couldn't get your hands on any VHS tape or anything. But comic books, the vendor wouldn't know what's in them. So certain ones you knew, like there'd be like some boobs in there or something, you know. And so that was kind of my first exposure to like kind of sexual stuff was like through these comic books, you know, that were like drawn like sometimes in real detail, and like some of them were like completely amazing, like sometimes watercolor and stuff, you know, like, and it was just like really kind of this vivid thing. And I don't know, just having this book in your hand and sliding in your bag and just can't, you know, just not being able to wait to get home and be by yourself kind of thing is a memory I have as a kid. I sound like a complete pervert right now, but like I think like being able to replicate that in some scenes in my book, none of them are gratuitous. They have to do with a storyline or character development. But doing that is kind of nostalgic in the sense where like maybe, you know, if so a younger person like reads my book, they like might have that kind of like emotion experience about it. And like, you know, between, you know, like, yeah, yeah, totally. And I think, again, I think it makes me seem like a total bastard. Like no, most people want to like emulate like Ashita no Joe or like Hokuto no Ken or Dragon Ball. They want that excitement of like fighting the bad guy. And I'm like, the excitement of being alone with this book in your room. You know, like I sound like a complete twisted bastard. But you know, I think that's probably where that comes from. And then, you know, a lot of comics in Japan are like really erotic. Inking in Japanese comics is like really reached certain levels of like, you know, like I think looking at Japanese comics and then looking at like European comics or American ones, the inking is a lot more like harsh when it comes to like Western art, you know, and the Asian art, they come from a tradition of line and stuff. And so like you have like really slight lines to the point sometimes where like the lines are barely visible and it's just like really, really soft. So I like to play with both. Sometimes I got like really bold, like just kind of like stuff in there. And sometimes, you know, maybe for like the more erotic scenes, like the line quality changes. And that's just to, you know, again, I think any kind of art, not just comic books, it's all about evoking a certain emotion in the viewer. Try to do that as much as possible with my work. So that's why sometimes the styles change, and I think that's part of my style. So yeah, I got that probably from like European comics, definitely Argentine comics, and also Japanese. I think eroticism is kind of like not very present in American comics per se, even though you've got like heroines that are like flying around wearing like in spandex, but like it's still kind of like really subdued. I guess that's not the point either, you know. So, and eroticism and pornography are also very different things. And like, I'm completely not going for pornography in what I do, you know?
Yeah. Thanks for sitting down for an interview. Glad to finally call you. Hooray.